Yeah, man. You count with this, man. Whatever it is, it ain't enough. Cause I need some more.
Money, trying to keep it in something ugly, can't be front and bumming. Dead presidents run the country, debit or credit, paper or plastic, whatever suits you. I'm used to never having enough, so whatever you do, I stack it.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Money and Values. Everyone's familiar with the fact that the value of money changes over time. Less familiar is the fact that the nature of money itself, what money is and how it functions, also changes, sometimes very drastically. We're in such a period now. One purpose of a central bank, of a treasury department, and of other major financial regulatory institutions is to ensure that the value and nature of money change in stable, predictable ways so that markets and economies can function. However, we're in a period where the ability of these institutions to serve this purpose is rapidly deteriorating. As a result, the future of the nature of money is up for grabs. Money and Values is a program dedicated to exploring issues related to the nature of money, how it's changing, and what that means for people throughout this economic system. My name is Dave Adelson, and I'm an economic layperson. That is, I lack any particular knowledge or training in economics other than what I've picked up through reading and through various media channels. Max Fried Wolf is a trained economist and freelance writer based in New York. In addition to his writing on economics, he does contract research on international financial risks and opportunities while teaching in the New School's University's graduate program in international affairs. Good morning, Max.
Good morning, and great to be here, and thanks to everyone out there listening.
Today, Thursday, November 13th, 2008, we'll be taking a look at issues related to the housing market, credit markets, and the so-called Troubled Assets Relief Program, or TARP, sometimes also referred to as the $700 billion bailout bill. Yesterday, Henry Paulson conducted a remarkable press conference where he announced that the Treasury had scrapped plans to conduct auctions to purchase troubled asset-backed securities at auction, a process that was the centerpiece of the administration's proposal that led to the passage of the TARP program. And one of the questions that came up was, had Congress been misled during the course of the passage of this bill? But what's going on, Max? What's the situation? Why did they scrap the program? Why was it in there in the first place? And what was the move with respect to Congress?
Well, sadly, exactly what's going on going forward just became harder to know, not easier. We know that the original plan, much debated, initially defeated in the House of Representatives, later passed by the Senate and then the House of Representatives, to buy troubled assets off the books of various financial institutions to leave them with more cash and less risk so that they could continue to loan into the economy, has not worked. We know that in part because across September and then October, we saw a freeze and a breakdown in lending in the global economy and in the U.S. economy, which has rapidly worsened and accelerated the macroeconomic downturn. So it was clear that while it probably would have been worse without the TARP had hardly proved to miraculously transform. About 290 of the total $700 billion has now been spent. And so the question becomes what to do with the next $410 billion. And to some extent, Mr. Paulson, Secretary Paulson, speaks to that yesterday when he comes out and says, okay, new plans for the remaining $410 billion. Different from the first $290 billion. And what we're going to do now is try to use government money to get private players into what are called asset-backed securities. And that means bundles of loans, investing in bundles of loans. And those bundles of loans are loans for cars, auto loans, loans for credit card loans, and loans for student borrowings to go to college and university.
And what's the proposal to get private money into that space?
Basically, I think to use government money to put a floor under the value of some of these assets. Another way to think about this is they're now targeting the collapsing consumer spending because consumer spending is collapsing, and it's the part of the economy that the general public sees most immediately and most sort of upfront and personal. You know, and it's worthy of mentioning that consumer spending is about 70% of U.S. GDP. So to the extent that you have precipitous and sustained declines in consumer spending, which we're now seeing, you can basically translate that very quickly into negative GDP growth rising unemployment and rising anguish and anger in the general public.
When we're talking about these securities that they're going to be backing, how big a market are we talking about, and how much money are they? I mean, how much money do you think would be needed to really put into that sector to change the value of those securities out on an open market?
You're talking about what was until fairly recently a $2.5 to $3.5 trillion with a T, so trillion or $1,000 billion market here for asset-backed securities, excluding mortgages. Although they're interested in trying to help the mortgage market too, and if you add that in, then you're talking about a $12 trillion market virtually
that you're trying to prop up with now what is $410 billion left in.
Well,
your...
the idea is that you would give a short. First of all, the market has declined enormously, so it was. Billions, and it was, you know, trillions more last year than it is this year. It's collapsed, this market. So the market is nowhere near as big as it was, which is the problem, to be honest. And what you're talking about trying to do is use a couple of $100 billion in Treasury-backed assurances and interventions to try to lure in and increase the confidence of lots and lots and lots of money sitting on the sidelines from private investors who have been afraid to go into this area or afraid to buy these assets because they fear that these assets will continue to lose their value as consumers continue to have difficulty making payments on cars and college loans and credit card loans and home loans. And that takes the form of increasing delinquencies, late payments, and increasingly increasing defaults, you know, or absence of payment.
When we're talking about all this money on the sidelines, and that's a phrase I've heard repeatedly over the past months or year, are we talking about people who basically saw this meltdown coming and pulled out their money, took their profits some time ago, and have been sitting waiting to let the whole thing bottom out before they come back in? Is that what we're talking about?
Most of you have people who sold anything. Might have been up, it might have been down. And they may have sold before the crash, and many of them sold during the crash and locked in a lot of their losses and are sitting on the sidelines, which means sitting in cash. Probably one of the most popular ways to think of that, what people often mean by cash on the sidelines in this business, is they take a look at just how much money is sitting in money market mutual funds as basically cash, you know, very liquid cash, and more or less, they're sitting there to take a good opportunity should one come, but otherwise to leave their money in a very safe place. And that's built up by people, a small number of whom saw it all coming and dodged it artfully, and probably much more honestly by a lot of people who've sold something and didn't buy anything else, whether that whatever they sold was up or down.
So,
and the just so you know, the relationship between the amount of money sitting in money market mutual funds versus the amount of money invested is breaking through its highs in recorded history, which in this business means since the 1970s.
And that ratio is what?
Right now it's about 0.4, which is
so
kind of
40% of the money is just getting whatever the money market yield is, and that must be very low right now because
under 2%. Yeah.
Yeah. And just so people understand, money market, it's just so I understand, a money market is a place where the money that's sitting in those accounts is used to fund short-term borrowing at whatever the prevailing rate is. Is that correct?
Pretty much. I mean, there are some differences or some different types of money market funds, but basically you give your money to a large bank or institution, which then gives it to a bank, and they make small, very safe, very short-term investments with your money, and you get a very low interest rate, you know,
but
not much more than you'd get from a savings account at a bank, in some cases less.
Well, while we're talking about this, can I ask an ignorant question? If the fear in the market is such that the cost of borrowing or the skepticism about the credit worthiness of even short-term borrowers is at such a state that the rates are fairly high, should money market rates go up in a situation like that?
They might, but the government doesn't want them to go up.
Because?
Because lots of firms rely on short-term borrowing at low rates to fund their operations. And if it suddenly became much more expensive for them to do that, that would be a problem.
How does the government have any control over what that rate is?
They don't directly control it, but they can target it by lowering interest rates.
And that's the Fed here.
The Fed, yeah. Federal Reserve System can lower interest rates, which in fact they've done. The other thing that's worth to keep in mind, the government is not some sort of absent party in the economy that only looks at the economy and tries to help everyone else. The government is very much involved in the economy. And one place that you see a lot of short-term money going, I mean, in other words, money market type deposits end up getting loans to, is Uncle Sam, who borrows them in something called the short-term treasury market. And a lot of the money in money markets is actually lent to the U.S. federal government over, you know, short periods of time so that the U.S. government can continue its operations.
That is something that is so confusing to me, given the commonly repeated refrain about the government's capacity to print money. So why would the government be borrowing money instead of printing money, particularly if it can set rates?
If the government prints money, it increases the money supply and does something that can that creates inflationary pressure. If the government borrows money, it doesn't. It doesn't change the amount of money supply that we have. It just changes who's got the money. If it borrows, it takes the money from someone else and spends it. And so there's no change in the amount of money in circulation. There's simply a change in who has control over it for the mm-hmm. moment. Whereas if the government prints money to spend, that it increases the total amount of money out there, and all things being equal, the more money chasing goods and services out in the economy we have, the more upward pressure there is on the prices of goods and services, and we call that an inflationary tendency.
Okay. Well, coming back to the original point, we've got a troubled asset relief program, which has $60 billion yet to be spent anyway. Henry Paulson and the group that the oversight board created sees fit. And then we've got another $350 billion that has to be authorized, or at least you have to go back to Congress. I don't know the technical details of it, but you have to go back to Congress and get them to release it.
And the wisdom, by the way, is that Paulson and company will probably not do that prior to the period of transition here between the Bush presidency and the coming Obama presidency. Well, the idea is they're going to work within the already authorized to the best of their ability for as long as they can and not risk all the trouble of going back and asking for a reauthorization in Congress and leave that to whoever is the Treasury Secretary under President Obama.
Well, I thought there was another reason, and that was that coming into it, the Treasury Department seemed to be saying, look, we can't tell you exactly how we're going to execute this. And part of that was because it was complicated, and part of it also was similar to reasoning that Paulson had put forward earlier, which is that if you signal exactly what you're doing, then the markets will figure out very quickly whether or not they think that it can work, and you can actually be defeated if they don't think you have enough money to do the job you're trying to do.
Be kind of played. There's a good reason for the federal government not to go overboard announcing the exact details of what it's going to do asset buying before it does, because they will be front run, what we call front running the market. In other words, if people knew they were going to buy XYZ assets before they did, they would run in there, buy those assets, bid them up, and then sell them after the government bought them. And then the government would be paying a lot of money for a relatively smaller impact.
But the main point is that Congress, I think, wanted to see how this program was going to work and be deployed, such that if there was dissatisfaction with it, they had an opportunity to put additional conditions on it when they came back for the second half of the money. And you said they're going to try and use this as long, make the remaining $60 billion last as long as they can. But my understanding is they're burning through it at an exceptionally high rate, and that $60 billion is going to be gone quickly. I mean, haven't they put a chunk of...
Well, they foot dragged. I mean, after the sting and sort of free fall that occurred with the initial rejection by the House of the TARP, then when they finally got the money, they sort of foot dragged in the early phases. They weren't spending money all that quickly. Then as markets continued to fall and they came under enormous pressure, they started spending the money more quickly on buying certain troubled assets. Although that whole modus operandi is what Paulson announced he was formally abandoning in yesterday's press conference, when he gets up there and says, okay, we're going to stop investing so much in trying to provide balance sheet strength, more cash, and reduce the risk on balance sheets by buying select assets. And we're going to move toward using assurances and influence in international capital markets to try to induce more private investment into the asset-backed securities.
And just so I'm clear, they did not at any time actually conduct those purchases, right? In other words,
they did. They did make some purchases, not large or major purchases, but I think they did do some purchasing. Again, part of the reason I can't answer that question fully is my own ignorance, but a large part of it is that the Treasury has not been good, which is quite unfortunate, at living up to its transparency obligations. They've been quite closed-lipped and quite less than interested in providing all the details. I mean, that even goes as far as they have redacted or blacked out segments of their contractual involvement with firms that are helping them operate in the market, so we can't even see what they're paying.
Now, when you say we, do you just mean the
public,
or does Congress have access to those data?
I think that Congress is still waiting for that data, and I know for a fact that the public doesn't have it.
Okay, well, where are we in this? We've got a government that is scrambling to plug a hole that's widening very rapidly. Where do you think this goes from here?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is we are still very much in a reactive mode. And in order to really solve or begin to rebuild confidence and induce people back into markets, we would need regulatory action, government intervention here, that was proactive more than reactive. We are constantly behind the ball, we here being the regulation, is constantly behind and trying to catch up with a situation that continuously worsens. So it's a little bit that we're always putting out the last fire as the next one breaks out.
But isn't a part of that related to the fact that it's a little difficult for anybody to really understand how this de facto financial system that developed outside any regulatory framework really functions? So in other words, you don't know exactly what to do because you don't know exactly what's happening, and you can only make a judgment what needed to be done after something happened. Like with the Lehman Brothers failure, they weren't sure what the systemic impact of that failure was going to be.
Right, but you're never sure, right? I mean, basically, in my humble opinion, when the histories of this episode are written, and there will be many, they will be contested, the decision to allow Lehman to fail was a catastrophic misadventure. It was absolutely disastrous. We are still feeling the ramifications, and that was the mistake that shook the world. It literally destroyed trillions of dollars in stock market wealth all over the world. It was a massive error.
But isn't that money that was created and now destroyed? And I want to understand this
sure.
money creation and extinction process better. But can't the argument be made that all the inflated prices were wholly unjustified?
Many of them probably were.
Actually, this is a good spot. I'd like to play for you just a brief clip of Rick Santelli speaking on CNBC yesterday, if I could, and get your
sure.
thoughts on that.
A viable loan is probably going to be at a spread that's much higher even than where we're at, and it still underscores that five-year period we've come from where $6 to $7 trillion of wealth was created that didn't deserve to exist. And I see people on our own channel saying, oh my God, the stock market has taken away $3 or $4 trillion. The reality is it shouldn't have existed to begin with.
So what do you think of that comment?
That comment speaks to the following notion, which I think is decreasingly controversial. If you have too loose monetary policy for many years with poor underwriting or credit quality standards and low interest rates, then you pump out into the world lots and lots of loans. And what those loans do is they buy lots of things. They buy houses and push up the prices of houses. They buy cars and push up the prices of cars. And they buy stocks and bonds and push up the prices of stocks and bonds. When, however, you suddenly realize that you've made too many loans, you suddenly have to stop making so many loans. And not just that, but making bad loans means that a certain amount of the money you lent out won't be paid back and will therefore that purchasing power will be destroyed.
And it won't be paid back because somebody suddenly isn't able to keep up and they default, and then there's a cascade of defaults.
Either they can't keep up or they don't want to keep up. I mean, to some extent, it's not just inability to pay. That's the bigger issue with the general public, but it's not always the biggest issue with business. To some extent, continuing to pay off something you bought in the past, when you have to pay off principal and interest, and if the thing you bought is now worth a whole lot less than you paid for it, you may be better off just walking away from the whole thing than continuing to go crazy paying off something which will never be worth what you have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Or you may want to walk away from obligations you incurred, like, for example, pension obligations.
Sure, you may want to walk away from houses. I mean, to some extent, some people would unambiguously be much better off losing their house. Otherwise, they risk spending the next better part of the next 30 years paying 160% of what the house is worth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the most appealing situation to be in, right?
So coming back to this issue of the Lehman Brothers failure, there's two points. One is you say it extinguished a lot of wealth, but this comes back to my longest standing question of the relationship between wealth as measured by, you know, the number of dollars you have in some account somewhere versus the amount of value that you have access to. So if the
value
of money is changing all over the place, figuring out the relationship between my monetary wealth and actual value is very difficult.
Yeah, look, when there's tons of money out there chasing goods, then a dollar in cash is not worth very much, right? Because everyone can get credit and there's tons of credit out there, and the credit out there bids up the prices of things. When credit is destroyed, especially in a large systematic destruction, cash becomes more and more valuable and things become less valuable because they're losing their value and there's no credit standing behind people to buy things.
Well, right? That's a little bit of a philosophical issue. I think the value of things stays where it is, and the amount of money, the money value, the value in trade for money may be changing, but the inherent value
to me. Sure, but
we
tend to measure things and the value of things in terms of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so saying that the value of money, cash rises, or the price of things fall, mm-hmm. is actually two ways of saying the same thing, given the standard way that we use money as a measure of value.
Well, but I think we should look at that standard way of using those terms because, for example, if you have a system where money's being created or extinguished based on decisions by either a central bank or in some unregulated market, you may not be, and I am not, altogether entirely comfortable with calculating it in that way because essentially that transfers all the authority, if you will, over the determination of values to factors outside ourselves.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it depends on how you want to, determine and what values and ethics you want to bundle into your determination of what the word value does or should mean. So
that's
most certainly true. But what Mr. Santelli is referring to is kind of the big issue of the day, which is, should we be trying to stop the destruction of wealth we should have never allowed to proceed? And if so, how much and when and where? And who should we bail and who should we not bail? Because increasingly, policy and Washington is making life and death decisions for industries, businesses, firms, thousands of employees, retirees, and those people dependent on them in the communities in which they live and function.
And so your position is that the failure of Lehman Brothers was a disaster because what? It created a whole cascading set of consequences that couldn't be managed?
And Lehman Brothers was basically, you know, obviously overly indebted, many mistakes. It was basically a well-run firm in the other 95% of it. And I would remind people, in the third quarter of 2008, the last quarter of its existence, other than writing down the value of its assets as they declined in the market, Lehman Brothers turned on operations a $700 million profit and was profitably operating in a dozen countries with 23,000 employees. In other words, the only real problem at Lehman, and it was a big one, so not to downplay it, but the only real problem at Lehman was the value of the assets on its books, which were collapsing. And that brought down the firm because everybody lost confidence in doing business with Lehman, which has now been bought out by Barclays, a British bank, which will almost certainly make a handsome profit on their purchase, which they were able to get at a fire sale, ludicrous price of a couple of $100 million plus the assumption of debt.
And I'd just like to remind people that you're listening to Money and Values, a program about money, the changing value of money, and the changing nature of money from a perspective that's hopefully different than one you get elsewhere. My name is Dave Adelson, and I'm speaking to Max Fraud Wolf in New York. You can find us online at moneyandvalues.net. You'll find this show, all our previous and future podcasts, as well as a blog to discuss the issues you've heard here. And I hope you check it out, moneyandvalues.net. Let us know what you think. And actually, while we're on that subject, there was the recent report in the Washington Post about a change that Treasury made in tax law that allowed a bank acquiring another bank to write off its debt, which amounted to a huge tax credit for banks.
It's a huge inducement to say the government will basically relieve you of huge portions of your tax burden if you buy out a bank with big losses.
And did that apply to Barclays' purchase of Lehman, or was it only applying to commercial banks?
I don't know if it applies to Barclays' purchase of Lehman, but it most certainly finds its way into J.P. Morgan's purchase of Washington Mutual and Wells Fargo's purchase of Wachovia, because they're going to be able to write $90 billion in losses off on the Wachovia book against their federal taxation there at Wells Fargo, which is no minor matter. The change of that particular law that was kind of bundled in there around the TARP,
Section 382 was
on the wish list of corporate mergers and acquisitions people and sort of anti-tax activist attorneys for the better part of 15 or 20 years, ever since they introduced the restriction against that. And it was sort of surreptitiously slipped in around when everybody was paying no attention to that in the midst of the economic meltdown in the TARP. And it's controversial. There are folks out there claiming that it's illegal, although Treasury Secretary Paulson and others have said that it is legal. So I assume you're going to see more discussion of that loophole, and it may be closed again by the next Congress.
And can you explain just for a moment the rationale for either allowing or disallowing this tax write-off?
The rationale is you don't want companies, profitable companies, going out there and buying companies that are collapsing just to not pay their federal taxes and then shutting down the companies and firing their employees. Because then what happens is the company that's in trouble gets nominally saved, but gets really dissolved. There's no economic benefit. And the already more profitable or successful company figures out a way to basically buy a company, kill it, and then use its past misadventures of the other company to avoid paying its taxes, which reduces the tax that the governments and the states would get and doesn't really do anything to help the economy, because the successful firm is really only interested in buying the tax get-out-of-jail-free card from the failing firm. It doesn't really help the economy, hurts tax revenues, and gives a windfall reduction in tax exposure to a bunch of companies that were doing okay anyway. So it's not too terribly desirable. The reason to do it, I suppose, would be to create buyers for some very weak financial institutions who would suddenly have value to other firms now as a tax reduction when they may not have value under any other real consideration.
But fundamentally what was done was that increased the size of the it increased the amount of money that could be given to banks to conduct business outside of requiring an authorization from Congress.
Right. Well, what the tax provision does is allow them to write off the combined losses from a merger. Right.
Right. Okay, well, coming back to the Lehman thing, the other point with regard to allowing it to collapse is without people having seen the cascading impact of that kind of rescue, you continue along the road in your rickety wagon that's about to fall apart. So isn't it also possible? And there's this issue of moral hazard, which keeps coming up, which is if you proactively had stepped in and tried to rescue a lot of firms that had taken risks that they couldn't bear, then the argument comes, let's put it this way. It becomes politically untenable until people see consequences that affect them to step in and say, "Hey, we're gonna take care of your bad decisions in a so-called free market."
That argument was made, okay, but they didn't get much out of it. They let Lehman, a successful company that was the fourth largest and most powerful investment bank in the world 6 months ago, fail, decimating the New York economy, decimating that firm, decimating its employees. And then the next day they began $85 billion of what is now $170 billion of bailouts of AIG insurance. So the moral hazard and, you know, drawing a line in the sand argument lasted for less than 12 hours.
What about
and we don't have Lehman Brothers. And also, you know, it becomes dangerous for the federal government to randomly pick who lives and who dies. So on the 15th of September, they decide to kill Lehman Brothers. And on the 16th, they began spending what will probably be over $150 billion to keep AIG alive. Why is that a good idea? And they arranged a shotgun wedding of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America and then allowed Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs to decide they were commercial banks, not investment banks, and borrow money really cheap and really plentiful from the federal government in a way that was never an option made available to Lehman Brothers. In other words, it's pretty random who they're letting succeed and fail, or worse than random, it has to do with who's got a better relationship with the regulators. I don't think, you know, you're getting toward a better, newer world or way of running an economy by saying, okay, some firms will randomly be allowed to fail, others won't, and what might help or hurt you is how friendly you are with the regulator. I mean, I'm not sure that's really good.
Well, then through what process could an unsustainable expansion of credit have been brought back in? I mean, I cannot see any way that could have been done in what's euphemistically, well, in an, quote, orderly way.
The only orderly way to do it is to prevent the bubble from inflating over that many years to that large of a size.
Right, but right. That had happened. And so we're in a car that's rolling down the road or a wagon that's rolling down the road that can't hold together. And so to say that, well, this bump or that bump or the fact that you turned down that road caused the car to fall apart, to me, I don't quite understand it. It from my perspective, I wonder
it
whether...
It doesn't matter which way you turn on the road. In other words, driving over toward the edge of the cliff when your brakes don't work isn't really a great idea.
Okay, well...
You know, but I mean, I think you make a good point, but the other counterpoint is then we have to be honest. We have to say, look, our house is on fire. We're not going to save all our belongings. What do we grab and run outside with, and what do we leave in here to burn?
And this is where what I hear from free marketeers is, well, you let the free market decide. But in fact, if the free market decides, not only your house goes up in smoke, but the whole block goes. And
yeah.
My view is that when you're talking about this decision, despite all the defamation of government, it is in some sense a political decision,
mm-hmm.
right? And
absolutely.
And so there has to be some institution that mediates the variety of political interests. Now, I'm not somebody who believes
that be Henry Paulson. I mean,
right. Henry Paulson is not an institution.
Right.
So
we need a social discussion. Look, the general public has been left out of the debate about what is and isn't worth saving in their national economy.
But the argument for some time has been that the public and political institutions should stay the hell out. The decision should be made in markets.
Okay, that was the ideological commitment and the basic belief. Until everything fell apart. And it was never really true anyway. It was much more rhetoric.
And I think that it was rhetoric that backed the idea that people who had the predominant amount of monetary wealth in the society should get to decide all these allocations and other people should stay the hell out of their decision making.
Yeah, there's a great quote from a famous economist, Sir Jonathan Eatwell, who actually once taught here at the New School University where I teach now. And he said, markets are like fire. They're a wonderful servant and a brutal master. So when the economy is going your way and the market, like fire, is your servant, then it vanquishes and burns your enemy and bestows great light and warmth upon you. When you lose control and don't like the way things are going, the market, like fire, becomes not a wonderful servant but a brutal master and burns you to a crisp, and you suddenly want the fire department to come in there and put out the flames.
So... I want to ask where we are now in this process. I am under the impression that we are nowhere close to the evaporation of a lot of this monetary wealth. Nowhere close to the end of the process of evaporation of monetary wealth. And part of me thinks, you know, to an extent, perhaps it's a good thing because there's probably been such a misallocation of value. In other words, resources flowing to the wrong places because of this, and that some of this is going to cause people to fall back on questions about what is genuinely valuable. The U.S. consumer, which is the, you know, very much a global driver of economies because we're such well-trained consumers and we're the outlet for a whole lot of production, is suddenly confronting decisions that he, she, we, I didn't have to confront in the past. I can live with less. I can consume less. As a matter of fact, I can consume less quite easily, quite comfortably. It's just a slight change in my outlook that allows me to consume less. Well, if that attitude spreads broadly, is that not terrifying to an economic system that is built upon a sort of psychotic level of consumption? But from the perspective of the planet, is that not a good thing?
Look, there are always upsides. You know, there are always silver linings. I don't think that a lot of people are going to have as easy a time as some will with the new reduced consumption, because for many people, the new reduced public consumption means that they get fired.
Well, and there's also another issue, which is that consumption was being driven by debt. So a lot of people have significant amounts of debt in credit cards, in home loans, in student loans, in car loans. And as the value of money collapses, the ability to hold on to a job collapses, the ability to pay back those loans is similarly collapsing.
Right. So you're going to have a lot of people who are going to struggle a lot longer and a lot harder to get a less good job to make less money, of which they'll be able to spend less than their lower salary after their period of employment, because they're going to have to spend a significant amount of money paying back debts that they accumulated previously.
Well, this brings me to the question of the decisions that are being made about where to pump money in. We're pumping money in to save banks so that people can get access to credit. I mean, that's a political decision, as opposed to what I would like to see, and I'll be honest with it. I would like to see the socialization of certain risks of just plain people, not the socialization of the risks of banks. So I would like to see a single payer health system that allows me to take economic risk because I know my health care is covered. I'd like to see the socialization of pension risks that allows me to take economic risks because I know that I'll at least have enough to eat and live on. What is the rationale for pumping all this money into the banking system? And then, as we hear so often, people saying, well, we're going to be very constrained in what we can do in other areas because our debt load has increased so much because of the money we poured into banks.
Well, part of the rationale for that has at least as much to do with politics as it does with economics, which is the bottom line is we tend to have presidents, congressmen, and senators of both parties who are owned by these various companies and industries and tend, therefore, to fairly well try to represent those people who own them. That's much more a political issue in many ways than an economic issue, but it does have bearing on your questions. I do think we're going to see a big debate about health care and pensions, I think, quite interestingly, because GM and Ford are presently flirting with the kind of bankruptcy action which might basically dump their pension and health care liabilities either wholly or ahead of schedule onto the federal government. And that will be not minor, and you'll see a heavy debate about that. I mean, for $4.60 as of right now, I'm looking at my trading screen here, for $4.60 you could buy one share of Ford and one share of GM, you know, or a medium latte at Starbucks.
Wow.
So we're talking about two companies, both of which have lost more than 95% of their value this year, in Ford and GM.
It's remarkable.
It is. And that's the destruction of wealth for you par excellence. Right?
And I think one of the most important points here is I think we're dealing with a real secular shift. We've been in a period that dates at least back to Reagan and probably before, where a certain trajectory in terms of the dominance of the money system was being followed, and that was a good thing. The money party made everybody at the party happy.
Or drunk.
Yeah, and now it's a mess. It's devastated. And I just have the feeling that the systems available for designing, for even considering what might be done in its place are too weak at this juncture.
They haven't developed. We're early into a cultural and secular shift.
But one of the things we're not early into is the folks whose responsibility is oversight of the existing economic and money system, thinking about what ought to come next. I feel that those discussions and that thinking is going on right now, and it's going on behind a veil of very technical language and a level of understanding of the functioning of money that's not shared by those of us on the sort of business end of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's been true a while. I mean, part of the reason we're so unable to figure out what to do as a society is because any discussion or consideration of non-free market outcomes and solutions
has been disallowed.
Well, has been called evil, pushed to the edges, marginalized, denounced, and ignored for 20 years. And so those voices and those theories, which are 100 plus years old, those experiments and those proposals have been sort of anemically wilting in the dark, and bringing them back into the light and reinvigorating our discussion and understanding of those issues, while important, won't be an instantaneous social process.
Well, if I could suddenly wave a wand and appoint you king of the world, and you could design it in the way you thought best, what would be some of the key principles that you would want to see implemented in a restructured economic system?
I think what you'd want to tell companies is that you'd want to look at their shortfall, you'd want to figure out what's going on with them, and whether or not their everyday continued operations can be profitable. If they can, I think you'd make an investment in them contingent on them maximizing their employment, and then you would take 75% of their operating gains over the next 5 years. And you would use that money to retrain people and to pay back into the public coffers to draw down the total indebtedness. And I think you would commit to a few basics, which would also help relieve some of the unemployment pressures. And those would be about the Social Security system, pensions, and national health care. And I would agree with you in the national health care. It's high time the United States joined the rest of the developing world there.
And just out of curiosity, where did the number 75% come from in terms of the amount of money you take back?
Because you don't want to give some situation where in the best case scenario the public can break even, because it tilts the risk reward badly against the public. You want to say, okay, we're coming in as your partner, and because you're desperate and we're your partner, we're going to take a great big piece of the action when together we make this succeed.
I don't think I understood what you just said. Can you break it down for me a little more simply? What I, as a just plain folk, should be arguing in favor of and pushing the government, pushing my congressperson to support?
I would be interested in giving government assistance to companies that make essential goods and services and can do so at least at a break-even level under a pretty short time frame. In other words, that you don't want to be investing in companies that are not profitable and cannot produce a competitive product, so that the more you invest in them, the more you have to invest in them in the future. To the extent that you've identified companies that are either break-even or better than break-even, profitable based on their operations, you would want those companies to make a maximum effort to retain the largest possible number of their employees. And they would have to pledge the majority, more than half, of their profit over the five-year turnaround period to the federal government to be used as general operating revenue.
But why would any company that's close enough to profitability agree to those terms?
Because it's operating. They may have huge amounts of debt that they can't pay off, but they're operating near or around break even. Right now, if you have to pay off a lot of debt, 10% of your revenue would have to go to debt. You'd have to make 110% of your expenses at all times to stay solvent. That's how a good company dies in a bad economic time.
I'm sorry, could you say it one more time? Because I think that's an important point.
If you need to pay 10% on your debts, right? and you break even on your operations, even in a bad time, because you're a good company, you're bankrupt because you can't pay off all your expenses and all the past debts you've accumulated without basically earning 10% more than you're earning. So you're insolvent, right? What a federal program can do is rescue those firms that are cash flow from operations neutral or positive, but wouldn't make it because of the difficulty of the economic situation.
But with such a program, what you're saying is, look, we need to be able to do this to give jobs to people who are in the same situation. In other words, hey, if I didn't have debt, I'm cool, right? But I have debt. Therefore, I can't pay my bills. I've got this credit card debt.
A lot of American households aren't cool without debt either because their entire standard of living is dependent on that debt. In other words, their whole life is organized around spending 115% of their annual income.
So just to be clear, what we're talking about is a program that gives them a place to go to work to get the money to pay back that 115%, or at least to stay on the treadmill and not fall off.
Yeah, and I think you also have to give the general public, in some cases, debt forgiveness. So you have to come in, see what they can afford to pay, not let them off light, but see what they can afford to pay, and write down their debt, give them a debt repayment program that has some relationship to their ability to pay.
And do you think that the
folks... You literally cannot squeeze blood from a rock.
And so out in the financial world that you operate in, I assume that a lot of what we're talking about here counts as heresy. But among the more thoughtful people in those sectors, do you think that they see the necessity of doing these sorts of things and could ultimately be persuaded to do them? And specifically here, I'm thinking of some of the big money bags fellows who are supportive of a guy like Barack Obama. Is this anathema to them, or are they willing to look at this sort of thing? And I'm not talking about the crazy-eyed ideologues who pretend there's such a thing as a truly free market without government intervention and want to be left alone.
Yeah, business folks tend to be significantly less ideological than policymakers and academics. And the other thing is, when things change as much and as fast as they have been lately, then, 3 months ago's heretic becomes tomorrow's prophet. And so opinions change as circumstances do. It's the times more than the man. That's always true, right?
Okay. There, one of the things that's going to dictate what is possible and what's not possible is not just U.S. public opinion, but also what's going on through global financial markets, because, we may come up with a perfect plan. Our legislators might even be willing to undertake it, but we have a set of obligations because our debt has been largely funded by foreign debt holders. And I want to talk a little bit before we finish up today about an article you sent me, which was published by Bloomberg by Shannon D. Harrington and Abigail Moses, titled Credit Swap Disclosure Obscures True Financial Risk. And just quickly, if you could explain for listeners who aren't yet familiar with what a credit default swap is, what it is, and why estimates of how much CDS exposure there is out there matter.
Okay, a credit default swap is basically a type of insurance. Legally, it's not insurance. It's not regulated. It's not only to be issued by insurance companies. It's not overseen for underwriter standards the way insurance is, but it functions like an insurance.
But one of the key points here is when an insurer issues a policy, the regulator makes sure that they have at least a certain amount of money against that policy that lets them make good on it. They don't have to keep $1 in reserve for every dollar of insurance they write, but they do have to keep – there is some ratio. So they might have to keep 15 cents, 10 cents, 20 cents, depending on risk, what the risk in that sector is agreed to be by a regulator.
Right. This is not insurance. It's just like an insurance product, but unregulated, unoverseen as of yet. The Federal Reserve is making increasing noise to the idea that it would like to become the regulator, and virtually everyone agrees that a regulator is badly needed. But as yet, we don't have a regulator, and it is not yet officially the Federal Reserve that is regulating. But what these contracts do is offer to pay the holder of the contract some portion of money should something that that person owns, which is specified in the contract, go into default. In other words,
my understanding was you could get these contracts on things you don't own.
Yes, you can also trade the contract. Usually they're initially written and then sold, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they come into being when somebody who owns, say, General Motors shares wants some protection in case General Motors goes bankrupt, goes into default on their bonds,
mm-hmm.
and they find someone who says, okay, if GM goes into default, we'll pay you 50% of the value, you know, 50 cents on the dollar or 100 cents on the dollar. We'll pay you money to offset or remove your loss. Then a secondary market developed in these instruments in which people who didn't actually own the underlying bond but wanted to bet that it might, they might be able to sell this insurance for more in the future, bought it.
I see. So I would say to you, and this was for anybody listening that wants a very nice description of this, if you go to our website, moneyandvalues.net, you'll find a link to a show that appeared on This American Life called Another Frightening Show About the Economy. And if you follow that link, you'll hear a program that explains that in greater detail. It's quite useful. But anyhow, going on, all these credit default swaps now exist out there, and there's some fear that with the defaults going on, there's going to be a claim on those insurance policies that were not backed up. And so do you want to talk a little bit about...
Yeah, we already saw that with Lehman. When Lehman went under, part of the dislocation was everybody realized that there had been tens of billions of dollars worth of credit default swaps on Lehman.
But when they had the auction where they tried, they were very worried that there was a great deal of exposure. But then they had an auction that, and the mechanics I don't quite understand, but the purpose of that auction was in part to clear all of those, that swap exposure. And they found out that the amount of exposure was not, on the scale that it had initially been expected or feared.
Right, because they waited until they had the auction and everybody had sold all their exposures off cheap, created a tanking global stock market.
So that had already, the losses had been absorbed already.
Yeah, part of the worst 4 days in the history of markets in 70 years, which was true at that point in late September, was everybody getting ready for that auction, which is why when the auction occurred, there wasn't that much left pain left to experience at the last minute. But there had also already been one of the worst sort of massive body blows to global asset markets that we'd seen in a generation or so.
So if there are further defaults by companies on which these bets had been placed, what's our exposure and what did this article by Bloomberg say about the size of that exposure?
Well, the size of the exposure is larger than is often admitted because they net out the exposures. In other words, there's a tangle of all these different insurance and I'll make you whole claim contracts out there.
So,
which have
so
a
somebody
value.
Somebody bought protection, but they also sold protection. So their net exposure is not the full amount, right?
Yeah, it's much smaller. The problem is that because these were unregulated and remain unregulated, and the underwriting standard or the standard for writing these contracts was very low, basically, the way that people raise money to honor their various promises to make each other whole or to pay each other is by selling assets. So while the net exposures may not be that high, in other words, the total value outstanding may not be enormous, the way that the money is raised to meet these obligations is often by firms selling distressed assets into disorderly markets in a hurry to raise cash, and that creates a sort of downward spiral. And that's why it's very dangerous. It's still systemically dangerous to the marketplace, even though the notional values aren't as high as some had feared and claimed.
And I'd just like to read a line from this article. So that the opening of this article says, "The most comprehensive report on unregulated credit default swaps did not disclose bets in the section of the more than $47 trillion market that helped destroy AIG, once the world's biggest insurer. Right. A report by the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation doesn't include privately negotiated credit default swaps that insurers such as AIG, MBIA Incorporated, and Ambac Financial Group sold to guarantee securities known as collateralized debt obligations. It includes only a small fraction of contracts linked to mortgage securities, according to Andrea Ciccione at BNP Paribas SA in London. New York-based DTCC's data released on its website November 4th showed a total of $33 trillion of transaction on governments, companies, and asset-backed securities worldwide based on gross numbers. Can you help put these numbers, the size of these numbers, in perspective? And what does what they're saying imply about the existing risk out there, i.e., if these things go bad, what are we going to see economically in as another leg down? What kind of body blow is out there waiting?
Well, what the numbers mean, short, and probably all you need to know, is that these unregulated areas of the financial sector grew in size to enormous value. So if the notional values are in the $30 to $50 trillion range, it means that the total value of unoverseen and murky quality assets is several times the GDP or gross domestic product or total amount of wealth produced in the country for a year.
And what is the U.S. GDP?
About $14.5 trillion per year. So it's many times that number. And the outstanding value of these things, and whether they go bust or not, in other words, whether people honor them or don't, what it means is that these enormous risks ballooned systemically without oversight or protection, and we now have their sometimes popping and sometimes not popping as a major structural pillar determining the everyday actions in our economy that people are subject to. Even if these things are honored, these insurance contracts are honored, then somehow firms are going to have to raise the tens of billions of dollars required to pay back the owners of these instruments if various companies go under.
So they have to do things like sell assets or cut costs.
Like sell assets, and that creates
in a time when there are no buyers.
Or nowhere near enough to absorb the sudden increase in supply that this means. And that means losses in your pension plan, losses in your retirement plan, losses in your brokerage account, and shocks to the system.
Well, I don't want to play the game of where are we, what inning are we in, but I think what I'm hearing you say is it's safe to say that we're not close to the declines, to being at a floor.
We could be close to a floor if enough positive things develop to help soften the blow from these negative things, okay? I think that the carnage is moving out of being concentrated in the financial markets, although I think there will be further trouble in the financial markets. But the carnage in the macro economy, the everyday Main Street economy that most people live in, I'm sad to say, is clearly just beginning.
And what kind of positive things, when you say if positive things happen, it could get
economic
better?
Economic growth. I mean, if we can get through the recession and it's less bad than I think it'll be, and unemployment can be kept from going above 8.5-9%, then we'll be a more robust national economy, and a healthier national economy with more jobs and better wages survives every economic trauma better.
One of the things that strikes me is that for those positive things to happen, it seems like there needs to be a fairly sizable reallocation of resources away from the speculative activities that have been driving so much of the growth. So there has to, in order for that bottoming process or a stabilization process to occur, there has to be significant transitions in where resources are directed. And that can't happen as long as the financial system, or can it happen as long as the financial system is so screwed up?
Yeah, but it's not just the financial system, right? It's the whole economy. I mean, we got into all this debt. We became wild speculators and debtors because our wages didn't cover our cost of living. And we tried one way after another of solving that problem without having higher wages, and each one of them eventually failed. And this one, debt as a substitute for rising wages, is now failing.
Okay, well, I think that's a reasonably good stopping point. Thanks a lot for your time today,
and
Max.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. You've been listening to Money and Values. My name is Dave Adelson. I've been speaking, as usual, to Max Fraud Wolf. You can find us online at moneyandvalues.net. That's moneyandvalues.net. We hope you participate in the discussion there. The program is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license. You can find out more about the Creative Commons family of licenses online at creativecommons.org. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And our theme song is Money, Money from the open source audio collection at archive.org. It's by Marcus Thrower on the track, RDJ on the rap, Impact on the vocals. Check them out. Paper or plastic, whatever suits you. I'm used to never having enough, so whatever you do, I stack it. I'm attracted to money like a magnet.